Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Rosemary Ellen Guiley with us. We just talked about her work on the Gin Connection. Up next, we're going to talk about dreams on Coast to Coast Day Out. And welcome back, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Rosemary, before we go to dreams, do you want to wrap up the Gin Connection for us? Put it all in perspective?
We need to be aware of who the Gin are and how they're interacting with us. And realize that we are sharing the planet with them. And that's the purpose of the Gin Connection, to educate people about how these entities are involved in so many of our encounters and experiences. They are quite likely playing very active roles in a lot of the upheaval going on the planet. They can be conjured and used for those purposes as well.
Well, you've done a remarkable job with this on the research, and I hope you keep at it, Rosemary. Good job.
Thank you.
Good job. And, of course, dreams. You've always done a good job on dreams. What got you fascinated in dreams in the first place?
Early experiences when I was a kid, my mother had a lot of precognitive dreams, and I had some paranormal experiences when I was a kid, fairies and angels. Most children have some kind of paranormal experience. But the idea that you could dream the future and it would happen, you could accurately dream the future, just astounded me when I was very young. And I wanted to know more. I wanted to learn about dreams. And when I got into my teens, I started experimenting with my dreams. I got books like, Harold Sherman was one of my early tutors, some of his work about how you can send dreams to people and how you travel in your dreams. I discovered that dreaming, in terms of our involvement in the spirit world, goes back to ancient times. So dreams became a very important avenue of exploration of the spirit world for me. And I learned how to astral travel. I never had the extent of precognitive dreaming that my mother did, which might have been a good thing because many of her dreams were about unhappy situations. But I did have other kinds of dreams, and I've realized how important they are in our daily life. They are a barometer of truth. They always reflect to us how we think we're doing in life, and they contain information to help us make decisions, make course corrections, restore balance in life, and they also are avenues for our spiritual growth as well. So I've done 6 books now on dreams, understanding dreams. My newest one is called The Pocket Dream Guide and Dictionary. And it's intended as a handbook to help people unravel the meaning of their dreams.
Rosemary, is science studying dreams? I mean, I know how they talk about, you know, they put electrodes up to people and things. But, I mean, are they really studying dreams to the point where one day we may be able to tap into the brain and actually see a dream as if we're watching a television show?
Yes, some researchers are doing that, exploring the potential for dreams to open up doorways to our untapped potential and to other realities. The ancients knew that dreams were a gateway to the spirit realms, that they were places that didn't exist here on Earth, and they were kind of in between. Plato called them the in-between state, where we could meet with the dead, with the gods and goddesses, so to speak. These experiences have continued in our dreaming life throughout history. So there are scientists who want to study the mechanisms of this, not just the chemicals that are involved in the process of dreaming, but the untapped spiritual potential and creative potential for using our dreams to maximize our intellectual powers, our creative powers, and very importantly, our healing powers.
Well, there's no question that, you know, in the dream state, we can do some incredible things. I mean, we can solve problems. We can do just about anything. Let's talk about dreams and their various facets and what their strengths might be, Rosemary. Let's start, first of all, with precognitive dreams. What causes that? Some people do it, Some people can't.
Some people have a natural affinity for precognitive dreaming, and we don't adequately understand the mechanism why some people are inherently more psychic in many respects than other people. Now, for my mother, for example, had a variety of entity contact experiences, and she was always very unsettled by this. It was difficult for her to cope with it, even if experiences were positive. And she was born this way. My grandmother had some of that ability too. And it manifests in different ways throughout families. For me, it was more entity contact through clairvoyance and things like that. But I have had a lot of very unusual dreaming. So anyone can learn how to develop those aspects of their dreams to at least some extent. Some people are very prolific lucid dreamers, but you can also learn how to become a lucid dreamer. The more attention you pay your dreams, the more they talk to you, the more information they give you, and the richer your dreaming life becomes.
How do you know that this precognitive dream is indeed something, a glimpse into the future? Should you record them? Should you write them down? And maybe if it happens, start paying a little bit more attention to them?
Precognitive dreams always have a different signature than ordinary dreams, and it varies by individuals. We all seem to have our own litmus test for periodic psychic dreaming. Some people will only have precognitive dreams a few times in their lifetimes, and other people will have them quite frequently. They learn over time by paying attention to their dreams, by recording them, what the signals are that distinguish precognitive dreams. Let's take the example of an airplane crash. To dream of an airplane crash is not automatically precognitive. It could be symbolic of something going on in your life, that something is crashing to earth. You've been flying too high, or you're flying in the wrong direction, or something that you thought would fly isn't going to make it. There are a lot of ways to interpret something like that. But with the right set of conditions associated with that, and also repeating dreams, precognitive dreams will often repeat, we learn to distinguish whether or not something is a harbinger of an event that's going to happen. In one of my dream books, I have the example of, I think it happened around 1980, 79 or 80. It was a DC-10 that took off from Chicago and crashed on landing. An engine fell off, and hundreds of people were killed. Well, there was a man who dreamed of this event almost every night for a couple of weeks before it happened, and he knew that he was seeing the future, that this was going to happen. The problem was he didn't know where, when, and what airline. And that's often the case with precognitive dreams. We're missing key elements that help us determine exactly what's going to happen.
How does it work? I mean, how in God's name, Rosemary, can someone, whether it's a remote viewer or a precognitive dreamer, tap into the future when it hasn't even happened yet? Maybe it has.
In the sense of eternal time, it's already taken place. And in our reality, these are forces in motion. There are circumstances, choices, all sorts of things that contribute to an event. They become forces in motion. And things can impact this. Things can divert forces in motion. They can magnify them. And events that take place, at some point, they reach a critical mass, just like an airplane taking off. It reaches a critical speed. It has to take off. So forces in motion reach a critical mass where the event actually then takes place in physical reality. Some people have the ability to tune into these forces in motion. Now, a lot of times when people have attempted to do studies of precognitive dreams and even do things like premonitions bureau, like let's collect all our precognitive dreams to avert disasters, people might actually be dreaming of probable events that never make it because something intervenes before critical mass happens. That's my own theory on it. And I see that pattern of activity in studying the nature of precognitive dreams.
Now, let's talk about lucid dreaming. Of course, a lucid dream is a dream where you know you're dreaming. So what's the significance of that?
We don't understand the full value of lucid dreaming, which is knowing you're dreaming while you're dreaming. And sometimes that's all you get is you suddenly realize that you're in a dream. Other times you have the ability to manipulate the dream, to decide what you're going to do. You're not just a passive player in your own dream, as most people are most of the time. You are directing the dream. You decide where you're going to go, what you're going to do, if you're going to stop something, start something. Many researchers believe that this kind of dreaming has tremendous potential for tapping into creative and healing powers. And these are the kinds of dreams that have been under intense study for decades now in terms of can we harness this energy? Can we teach ourselves how to lucidly dream? This may be a function, an evolutionary function, that more and more humans are going to literally be born into. I have met individuals who are prolific lucid dreamers. I mean, every night they are capable of having lucid dreams, and yet other people might only have them every now and then.
Now, with these dreams, these lucid dreams, the fact that you're in a dream and you can, and you know you're dreaming, and if you can control the outcome of the dream, how does that affect you in your real life, or does it?
It may help us harness our powers of intuition for making decisions. A dream seem to tap into a very deep level of our awareness, the higher self, which is like a radar sweep that's constantly looking out into the timescape for events that are shaping up, for decisions that we're going to have to make. And lucid dreaming seems to tap into that particular sweep of the timescape. So if we learn how to lucid dream, perhaps we are then better in touch with our intuition. We can make better decisions for ourselves. We can get in touch with our spiritual guidance, which manifests to different people in different ways, sometimes through the personalities of spirit guides, and other times through being more in touch with our higher self, with our own deep intuition.
What do you call the dreams, Rosemary, that allow you to accomplish goals and objectives? Is there any specific name for it?
Those are commonly called dream incubation or dream programming, and these are techniques that have been employed since ancient times to really put dreams to work for us. Before we go to sleep, we can instruct our dreaming mind to address a question, to give us the answer to a decision that we need to make, to point us in the right direction, to reveal a solution, to help us find a way to heal something in our lives, whether it's a physical illness or a life that's been, shredded by bad, disasters and bad luck.
Night terrors.
Night terrors take a variety of forms, disturbing dreams, nightmarish dreams to people where in some cases they might be pursued by dark forms, by dark people, and sometimes these dreams repeat, and they often contain the start of a profound healing process. Sometimes disturbing dreams are related to medical conditions, to psychological states, stress disorders and things like that. Sometimes they contain the start of a healing process, and they're disturbing because the dreaming self really needs to get our attention to address something that's way out of balance.
Are the night terrors tied into sleep paralysis or that old hag syndrome, Rosemary?
Yes, and it is possible for entities to interact with our dreams as well. And there are types of night terror dreams in which we are paralyzed. We sort of wake up into a limbo state where we're not fully awake, but we're not asleep either, and we're unable to move. While there is something, some horrible presence in the room. Now, we do go through natural states of paralysis while we're asleep and dreaming, but those particular kinds of dreams are related to disturbing entity visitations. I've come across those conditions in shadow people visits, in other kinds of, you know, demonic sorts of cases where people are being oppressed by a malevolent spirit. Sometimes people can actually employ dreams as curses to send entities to invade us while we're vulnerable during sleep, to cause nightmarish situations. So dream invasion is a real kind of dream, and sometimes we have dream invasions just by sleeping in negatively energetic places, haunted locations, and other times there are entities that have somehow zeroed in on us and are in the process of manipulating us in some way.
A dream that you're falling, what does that mean? Your career's over? You're dying? What is that?
It's one of the most common kinds of dreams, falling. And it's often an anxiety dream that we have when we're going through difficult times in life, where these dreams are often related to times when we feel we're just not in control of things. And it's often a horrible feeling in a dream to be in a free fall. There's a bit of folklore that holds that if you hit bottom in your dream, it means you're going to die. But this is more just a superstition than anything else. Plenty of people hit bottom in a falling dream, and they get a shock or a jolt, but it's not a harbinger of doom by any means. But if someone has repeated falling dreams, examine what's going on in your life where you're feeling out of control. It could be at work, could be at a relationship, it could be literally being at sea over making a major decision about something.
So I had a dream that people kept coming into my house that I didn't know, and they never would leave, and they kept coming and coming and coming. I even called 911. The cops never came. It was one of the most frustrating dreams I've ever had, Rosemary. What would you say about something like that?
If that were my dream, I would look at it in terms of my space and my time being invaded by things I can't control. And that's what these unknown people are. They're invading my home, which is symbolic of one's environment where we're supposed to have total control over our home.
Right.
Outside forces, the cops who are being called, outside forces have no impact on this. So the dream would be telling me that no one's going to help me get a handle on something that that I need to get control of. Other people are impacting me in ways. It could be time invasions, people asking me to do things that are not in my best interest, but taking up my space.
All right, Rosemary, let's come back in just a moment. We'll continue talking about the dream state. I want to ask you about when two people separately have about the same dream, they're sharing the same dream. How does that happen? More to come with Rosemary Ellen Guiley on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take a few calls for the rest of this hour, and of course, full of calls with Rosemary Ellen Guiley next hour, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Rosemary Ellen Guiley with us as we're talking about dreams and the Jinn connection as well, which is a spooky, spooky thing. I do have to ask you about a dream, and then I want to bounce back and forth a little bit this half hour, Rosemary, between these two subjects. But if somebody dreams of someone else and that other person dreams of that person, What is that? How are they doing that?
It's called mutual dreaming or shared dreaming, and seems to be a natural function of dreaming. It's probably more prevalent than we realize because most of the time we don't discuss our dreams with other people. But in some cultures, shared dreaming is not only common, it's expected that if you're connected to someone in an intimate way or you're part of a family, or a culture, a society, you would share the dreamscape with them the same way you would share the daily life environment. So sometimes we have shared dreams just as a demonstration of this connection. A shared dream could be the exact dream. It could have the same theme or the same elements. Sometimes shared dreams are just two people dreaming of each other on the same night in similar circumstances. And there may be elements of lucidity to it, too. Just like lucid dreams, shared dreams seem to be an advanced dreaming power that is probably part of our spiritual evolutionary track. We're going to have more and more of this as we evolve our consciousness.
Rosemary, if someone has such a horrible dream, frightening dream, could they die of a heart attack in their sleep?
You know, George, I don't know, but I have heard stories of people who have awakened in absolute terror from dreams with the heart pounding. And technically, is it possible to be scared to death? Yes, it is. These sorts of things do happen.
I mean, how do we know, for example, that some of these many cases of heart attacks in one sleep aren't caused by something like that? We just don't know.
Well, some of them might very well be. And in fact, from a magical perspective, if you were attempting to do something detrimental to a person through their dreams, that would be one avenue that you would send them a horrifying dream or an entity that would be able to physically attack them and harm them during their sleep. These sorts of concepts do exist in the magical literature.
Well, they sure do. Now, back to the djinn for a little bit. You also talk about a connection with reptilians, so explain that a little bit more.
The reptilian is a common presence in the ET abduction scenario, and then we also have a lot of beliefs about reptilian races who live in underneath the earth. Some of them are said to be extraterrestrial. We have creation stories about reptilian entities emerging from the earth to populate the planet. Reptilians are involved in the fall of human beings, the serpent, and the story of Adam and Eve. And the snake and reptile form are the most common form taken by the djinn. And so there's an interesting a connection there, again, linking the djinn to the ET abduction phenomenon. Conspiracy theories also get much deeper into the reptilian forms as well, that they're tied in with Illuminati and world conspiracy organizations. Some people believe that the reptilians are actually beneficial, that are benevolent. Here again, I don't think we can categorize any entity as all one disposition or the other, all good or all bad. I have interviewed people who've had terrifying encounters with humanoid reptilian beings, and I've interviewed people who've had encounters with reptilians that they feel are here to mingle among us, to be of help to us, to help us come into our full fruition of powers and creativity.
Well, you know, the research that you've done into this is fantastic. It really is. Are you concerned that you might have conjured any of these up to come and get you?
I have had encounters with unpleasant entities that are directly connected to my research. And yes, once you get on the radar, you never get off. And I have attracted the attention of beings who really do not want a whole lot of information about them out there. I have not been harassed to a large extent, knock on wood. I feel I have a lot of spiritual protection around me. I also have a very healthy respect for these entities, and I am attempting to understand them and their perspectives and their motives from their point of view as they engage with human beings. So I don't automatically consider them to be evil. There might be hostile ones, but that doesn't make them necessarily evil. So do I have troubling encounters? Yes, I do. I have, from time to time, had bedroom invasions by shadow people. I've had unpleasant things happen in my life that one would attribute to spirit interference. And sometimes it's difficult to make the call on that. But when a spate of things happens, a spate of things happen that follow a time when I've been doing a lot of intensive research, it's hard to ignore those connections. Sometimes when I've undertaken investigations of cases, I've had interference that seems to be for the purpose of blocking the investigation. Things happen to people to stop things, to cause things to be planned again. I've had a few physical marks on the body that seem to be retribution, you know, scratches and a bleeding cut or two. And it just sort of goes with the territory. There are times when I feel it's not prudent for me to go into a particular area, so to speak, of a line of inquiry. I need to back off for a while. And you have to learn, when it's time to hold them and when it's time to fold them.
I find it fascinating, though, that you believe that the jinn are responsible for most of these kinds of activities that we've had on this planet.
The evidence points in that direction. And once I started factoring the jinn into a lot of equations, even haunting investigations, a lot of things started making sense. And so, of course, I went out and consulted a lot of my colleagues in the field. Have you come across this? What is your explanation? Have you considered? And they were coming up against the same thing, like hauntings that involved a lot of very detrimental effects on people. Their health would be affected, mental oppression as well. Cases would not resolve. Shadow people were often a key component of that. And a lot of times a whole multitude of forms would be assaulting people. And I believe that the jinn can account for them all. I've had cases where I think a single jinn has accounted for a dozen or more manifestations, all of which were aimed at tormenting and harassing people. So factoring the jinn in suddenly made sense in a lot of cases that defied explanation and defied resolution. And then following these other trails into the other areas of the cryptids, the abduction scenarios, people with missing time, missing people. Missing people, some of these individuals might be persons who fall through interdimensional doorways and don't make it back, or they get kidnapped by entities and don't make it back.
You've got a segment on David Jacobs, who believes that ET visitations are not very benevolent at all. Tell me what you uncovered there.
Well, I do agree with David Jacobs that the abduction scenario is detrimental to human beings. And in the Jinn Connection, I comment on the works of other researchers and ways in which the Jinn have showed up in the documentation that they've accumulated. And in so doing, I do make the point that I'm not saying that their own interpretations are right or wrong, just that I see evidence for the Jinn in the testimonies and documentation they've done, and this needs to be brought into a better light. But here again, we find many similarities between the jinn and the kinds of things that David Jacobs has discovered, like the hybrid program, jinn entities, which could be jinn, that attach to people for life. They're like companions that attach to a person early in life and age along with them, and then become involved in a deeper relationship with them, and also the abduction scenario. And that these sorts of activities are for a purpose of infiltration. And we don't always know exactly what they're up to and why, but why would you infiltrate a population? You would want to subjugate them, you'd want to take them over, perhaps you'd want to eliminate them. So the evidence is there, and researchers have dug it out for the ETs, and we also need to realize that the jinn are among the entities who are participating in this.
All right, let's go to the phones east of the Rockies, Lawrence in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Lawrence, go ahead.
Hi. It's a great show tonight. My brain is on fire again.
Good.
This subject is really interesting, and what I'll say is that I've had some strange personal experiences. I had a very oppressive dream a couple of times, and I've come to believe that the jinn and the archons are similar, if not the same, and that they're parasitical, essentially, on the human race just to get bad reactions from them, et cetera. And I believe that that they're constantly, as you say, infiltrating and wishing to oppress. But I want to say that I think that the greatest defense against them is to be able to discern when you have a thought in your mind that is not your own, and then be able to say, well, that's not really something that I would normally think of, and then sort of segregate that and realize that maybe something is trying to get you to do something that you wouldn't normally do.
What do you think of that, Rosemary?
That's very good advice. Entities do have the capability of invading our thoughts and manipulating thoughts, and sometimes we're not very aware of that. I do have a chapter in the book where I discuss the archons and how well they fit the jinn template, and that many of these beings that we've engaged with throughout our history can be reinterpreted as jinn. They have the traits and characteristics the archons do, the Nephilim, the Watchers, the Anunnaki. Many of the gods, the early gods who had hybrid forms, could be jinn. And this points to a very significant involvement of a manipulative entity who's been part of our development from the very beginning. So, yes, self-awareness, being master of your own thoughts, your consciousness, pursuing a path of meditation and spiritual growth, very important to our autonomy. At the end of the Jinn Connection, I have a chapter called The Battle for Humanity, which is, you know, how do we combat these sorts of things? And some of the protection measures are taken from the ET abduction community. Ann Druffel was very good at interviewing people about what worked for them, and I've interviewed Jinn contactees as well. And some of the things that work the best in the long run are not Band-Aid kind of treatments, but what we call up from within ourselves, our own spiritual strength, our own sense of autonomy, what Druffel calls righteous anger, and I've used that myself in repelling unwanted presences, righteous anger, sovereignty, recognizing that we have sovereignty, and we have the right to autonomy, and because other beings who seem to be more powerful than us attempt to manipulate us, does not mean we should give over our authority and power to them. So there is a lot of self-awareness in this kind of approach, and that's really what's going to make the big difference in the long run.
Rosemary, with all these potential problems with the gin, you would think we'd find a way to repel them. We haven't, have we?
There are many ways that are very effective for repelling them, but the problem is none of them work in 100% of the cases, 100% of the time. We're dealing with very clever entities of different motivations, different power abilities, and of course human beings vary quite a bit in their ability to combat something as well. So a remedy that works very well for one person may not work at all for another. There are simple remedies like with shadow people. They're often affected by the EMF and electrical energy in an environment. Leaving lights on, computers, televisions can interfere with their ability to manifest. People have used all kinds of religious invocations and prayers. All religions have ways of dealing with unwanted spirit presences. They're all effective, but they're not effective in all cases. Oftentimes, we have to experiment to find something. Now, when we use religious remedies, we're also calling up our own spiritual strength, and that's very important as well. When we ask for the help of God or religious figures, we are connecting with them in a very deep way, and that helps us bring up our own defenses too.
Let's see if we can get Daniel in here, truck driving in Iowa, first-time caller. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi, I just have a question.
Sure.
I used to have a recurring dream about there being like a nuclear attack, and as I'm basically dying, I'm watching my family die and everything else, but I went through a divorce and I hadn't had this dream for several years, and then all of a sudden it just popped up.
Oh, it's bad.
But I've been reading this book, Invitation to Dream, to overcome it, but I can't seem to get past it. And the thing that's different about it is I'm in a new relationship. The people have changed. I just wonder if you could give me an idea of what's, you know,
all right,
what I
can
do. Or...
Hold that thought, Rosemary, because I want you to answer it when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel, I'll keep you on hold so you can hear it or you can listen to it on the radio. We'll be back in a moment with Rosemary Ellen Guiley on Coast to Coast AM.